first of all, it is important whenever we're interacting right now, I think, to keep those precautions in mind, right? Frequent hand washing, you know, cleaning surfaces on a fairly regular basis, avoiding people that are sick, that are potentially sneezing and coughing. You know, that's really why the 6-foot radius is what we've seen as the recommendation. And the reason why this is important is because what the data are starting to show us, there was a paper published on Monday in the journal Science that showed that, and again, this study came out of China, that showed that the majority of the infections they documented, 80% of the infections they documented were acquired from someone that was not documented to be infected. And what this is telling us is that it is the unidentified infections that are actually driving the transmission in the population. And so, unfortunately, what that means is that some people are going to be infected. They're going to be capable of transmitting the infection, but they may not necessarily be sick, be overtly ill, and they may even be either pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, but still possibly capable of transmitting the infection. That's why it's important that we ramp up testing and start to identify people that are infected. So in your particular case, I think, first of all, if you're going to be working in that environment, it is important to certainly exercise those additional precautions, cleaning, you know, good hygiene practices to try to reduce the potential for any transmission to occur if you happen to be around someone that's infected. The good news, I guess I would say, is that at least in the pediatric population, and again, based on the data I've seen so far, the children don't seem to be acquiring the infections at the same rate, and we need more data there to say for sure. But a relatively small number of total infections are actually documented to occur in children, so that's possibly good news. Although we need to keep our eye on that. As far as masks, I think if someone is ill, if they are coughing or sneezing, then a mask is an important way to control the potential for them to spread those large particle droplets into the environment around them or into someone else. As far as wearing one to prevent acquiring it from someone, that's of course an important means of protecting our healthcare workers. You know, at this point, I believe that the New Mexico Department of Health, their guidance is, and I would encourage you to go to their website and see what they say about this, and even reach out and look at the CDC's website for their guidance. But I believe their guidance at the current time does not recommend those that are not ill or not infected, does not recommend that they wear a mask. And that's part of that is to help preserve those resources for our healthcare workers that will be in contact with infected patients. So, you know, that's a bit of a challenging situation. I think, I guess my recommendation is to practice those standard precautions, try to maintain a clean environment, and if encourage the people you're around, the families you're around, the kids you're around, that if they are sick, that needs to be known by everyone and taken into consideration. So I wish I could give you a stronger recommendation than that, but, you know, just some things to consider.
All right, we do have another caller, but first I want to give that website. The New Mexico Department of Health has dedicated a site for you to stay informed and updated on coronavirus. That website is cv.nmhealth.org. That is cv.nmhealth.org. We now are going to go to another call. We have Ken joining us. Good afternoon, Ken.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a question?
Yeah, this is I heard earlier in your thing something about the interaction or the cause way back about bats. We live way out in the country where we get a lot of bats every summer, sometimes spring and fall, and they live in our porch up in the rafters, and there's droppings all over the place. So is there any correlation between all these bats and a higher risk of getting this stuff?
No, not that I'm aware of. You know, bats are they carry all sorts of diseases, not the least of which is rabies, which is a major reason to avoid bats and avoid interacting with bats. I'm aware of no reason why the presence of bats here, certainly in this region, would have any correlation to a higher likelihood of being exposed to this particular virus.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Ken. We now are going to another caller. We have San standing by. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Two questions for you. Actually, I'm a provider in the ER at Memorial, by the way.
Thanks
for
joining
us. How long does this virus reside on metallic and other surfaces? And question number two is, why does it take 12 to 18 months for a vaccine to get developed and available to the public?
Okay, good question. So the first question, if I heard you correctly, was how long does this virus survive on surfaces? New England Journal of Medicine published a paper just this week by some researchers, I believe, out of the NIH Integrated Research Facility in Maryland, that demonstrated that SARS-CoV-2 can survive on copper surfaces for really only a few hours, but can survive on plastic and stainless steel surfaces for up to 3 days. They were able to detect viable virus as far out as 3 days after inoculating these surfaces under experimental conditions. And so realize that those are typically those experiments are conducted under very controlled environmental conditions. Those are surfaces that are not typically exposed to UV light unless that's part of the study. But what that illustrates is that interior surfaces, for example, in a hospital, have the potential to hold viable virus for a not insignificant amount of time. So that's why regular cleaning becomes important here with EPA-approved disinfectants. The second question was, why does it take so long to get a vaccine? And that's an important question. So let me just give everyone a little bit of background on what's happening with vaccine development. So a phase one clinical trial evaluating an investigational vaccine actually began this week on Monday at the Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute in Seattle. And so this is a trial that's sponsored by the NIH and is going to enroll 45 healthy adult volunteers between the ages of 18 and 55. And each of those volunteers is going to receive two doses of this experimental vaccine each 28 days apart. But then they're going to be followed for a year. And this is the typical path that an experimental vaccine takes through a phase one clinical trial, which is to evaluate, first of all, safety. And so we have to ensure that this experimental vaccine is not going to cause any adverse events to occur and people that receive the vaccine. There have been examples of that have occurred in the past. And so that's very important to determine, one, the safety, but then two, also to determine whether there's a response and whether that response is appropriate based on the desired outcomes. And so these 45 volunteers are going to be monitored for a year beginning from this week. And if at the end the data demonstrate that those two doses were safe and that there was a response by the immune system, then the trial will progress to a much larger distribution of the vaccine and to a much larger study group and potentially can move forward from there. You know, we've learned some hard lessons in the past when it comes to biologics, therapeutics, and vaccines. There's no guarantee that there's not going to be some unintended consequence from the vaccine. And so these studies take a standard path to ensure that we're developing something that's safe. And that's really why it takes so long. And so that's, again, gets back to this issue of why we need to control the rate of the spread of the infection, allow people like you, you know, in Memorial Medical Center and Mountain View and hospitals all over the country to be able to manage the number of patients that are potentially going to require care, to be able to give them the care that they need, and get us out to a point where hopefully, you know, in a year to 18 months, we're talking about a vaccine that can be deployed on a wider scale.
Sam, thank you so much for the questions. And I also want to invite you to join us on our Facebook page where we are continuing the conversation. We have Casey Counts at our Facebook page taking questions from folks. Casey, I know you have some more questions.
Yes, Wesley wants to know, says, as an expert in microbiology research, what resources would Dr. Woods recommend as being the most credible and up-to-date with regard to emerging data and studies on the virulence factors, incubation period, et cetera, on this particular virus?
So I would recommend a few resources that I follow as far as data that's coming out and that's high quality and that's reliable and that's informative. And two of those are the Journal of the American Medical Association. So JAMA has an entire page dedicated to coronavirus resources, including interviews with people like Anthony Fauci and other leaders in the field. The New England Journal of Medicine is another high-quality journal that has a dedicated coronavirus resource page. Those are two that I probably follow the closest. A lot of that will be clinical information, what we're learning about the disease in people. As we start to see more and more studies, as more and more research groups and laboratories bring the virus into their lab and start to explore the biology of the virus, how it's working, what the virulence factors are and how they function, you know, we'll start to see those types of studies pop up in other journals as well. And so certainly, you know, any reputable scientific journal, you know, should be a pretty good resource, but I would recommend JAMA and the New England Journal probably as two places to start, at least right now.
Do you have another question, Casey?
Yes. Emmanuel wants to know, is the testing that will be conducted, is it going to be an immediate result or will it take a few days to get results?
So what's going to happen with the testing is as this testing becomes more common, and we're likely going to see some testing available or more testing available throughout the state as we move through the weekend and into early next week, that testing will be primarily, at least initially, my understanding is that testing will be directed at those that are showing symptoms that are consistent with infection or that have a travel history to specific locations where we know there is a high degree of community transmission. Those individuals will receive a nasal swab, and that swab will be placed in a vial of liquid viral transport media. And then it will be sent to the New Mexico State Health Lab in Albuquerque or possibly to the Tricor Lab, which is a public-private partnership that emerged out of UNM. And those laboratories are qualified or certified to run the CDC-approved diagnostic technique. But that will take a period of likely a few days to turn around an answer on that. So it is not an instant diagnostic technique. It's not a rapid test like we get in at the doctor's office for flu or strep. You know, this is not something that can be turned around in 15 minutes. It is going to take a few, you know, a couple or several days possibly to run the sample through the test. To run the test, to get the results back and report those results back to those individuals.
We want to remind folks that you can visit the New Mexico Department of Health website at cv.nmhealth.org. There are also some numbers that you can call. Casey, I believe you have some numbers for folks to call if they need more information.
That's funny. When you asked about numbers, Anthony, I thought you were talking about the latest numbers in terms of the totals
New Mexico. Okay, do you have those as
I do. That is what I have in front of me now. And the New Mexico State health officials announced that there had been 7 additional positive tests for COVID-19. So I believe that brings us to 35 right now. Bernalillo County has 20. There were 7 in Santa Fe County, 4 in Sandoval County. Socorro County has 2. San Miguel County has 1, and Taos County has 1. How long will it be before we hear that Doñana County or the southern counties are reporting coronavirus cases?
Thank you, Casey. We appreciate it. We are now going to move on to some other callers. If you are joining us, we're talking COVID-19 in New Mexico. Our guest is Dr. Michael Woods, an associate professor and director of the Biosciences Research Laboratory at the Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. He is answering your questions. We're now going to the phones where we have KC with a question. Hi, KC.
Hello.
Do you have a question?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. Dr. Woods, I'm very curious to know, in the late 1990s, I was teaching high school at a New Mexico public school. I was the last person to receive the flu vaccine. I rushed up there after the announcement came over the intercom. About 8.5 hours later, I began to feel ill, quite ill, and I ended up having to quit the job because I had to be out more than 55 days. I had unstoppable mucus in my lungs. I was actually afraid I thought it could even mean death at the time. When I went to 2 different MDs and a naturopathic physician, all 3 of whom told me never to take such a vaccine again, even though not every year, but 2 or 3 times previous to that, I had taken flu vaccines without a reaction. When I called the school, they said, well, there's no such thing as getting the flu from this vaccine. Perhaps you were allergic to dead chicken embryos. It was not a live organism that produced this vaccine. My question is, what is the source of the vaccine under investigation? And in a case like this, I have been very hesitant, I'll be honest with you. Since that time, I have never taken another flu vaccine. I have no symptoms. I'm quite sure I don't have the coronavirus at this time. But it does create a lot of apprehension about going out into public at a time like this. And I was wondering how you would view this with regard to the current vaccine under investigation and why, what your thought was about, it took 2.5 months to get over the first stage of that and 5 months for me to actually feel healthy again. And it was a devastating experience. I was just wondering how you would look at it.
Well, with respect to the vaccine that's under investigation right now, this is actually an mRNA vaccine. So actually what's being delivered or what's being explored as part of this vaccine is delivering a fragment of genetic information that is going to result in production of one specific component of this virus, and hopefully induce an immune response against that single fragment of the virus that will be protective, and that the immune system will then recognize that fragment in the presence of live virus and then be able to attack it. So the vaccine that's under investigation cannot possibly cause an infection because there is no intact virus present. Now, with respect to potential adverse outcomes from vaccination, we have some vaccines that are considered live attenuated vaccines, meaning those are pathogens that have been weakened to a point where they are still live, but they lack certain factors that make them especially virulent. And that what that does is that allows the immune response to overcome that infection and generate a protective immune response. In the case of the flu vaccine every year, typically that is a vaccine that lacks live virus. And that's why you were probably told, well, there's no possible way that you could have gotten the flu from this. And generally that's true. But certainly in the past, we've had to add certain components to vaccines to help stimulate an immune response. And we've seen historically that sometimes those components rare instances can cause adverse events. And it's possible that's what happened to you. I can't fully explain your situation. But that's why we do these safety studies. That's why it takes 12 to 18 months to talk about having a vaccine that's useful, because we need to ensure that there aren't going to be responses that are potentially detrimental within a large population of people. You know, we can't always predict the outcome, but by doing these studies, hopefully we can reduce or at least identify things like that that might be common, identify them early, and then take a different path. So generally, our vaccine technology today is generally very safe. We have novel ways to deliver vaccines that are much safer than how we did in the past. And our technology has allowed us to identify ways to create vaccines relatively quickly. The fact that we're talking about a vaccine here in March for a virus that we really didn't know about until the beginning of the year, that's extraordinary. These new techniques we have are intended to help reduce the potential for any adverse outcome.
All right. Thank you for the call. We are now going to go to Chris. This may be our last call. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hopefully just very quickly. I heard earlier, and I've read studies about the virus staying on stainless steel and plastic for 72 hours and on cardboard for 24. Question, how long would it stay on regular paper such as mail and or money, cash? Other question I have is wearing the mask, the facial mask for protection, is that a one-time wear or should you, I mean, can I use it more than once and stay safe? Or is it a disposable thing that you have to use a separate one each and every time?
Okay, we just have about 30 seconds for this answer.
With respect to how long it survives on paper or cash, anything I would say would be speculation at this point. I haven't seen data that demonstrates what that period of time is. With respect to using masks, unfortunately what we're seeing is that our healthcare providers are needing to stretch the time out that they use their masks because there is currently a shortage of access to those masks. That is not ideal. Hopefully that supply chain is going to open up here soon. You know, again, as how long is it effective? I can't say for sure.
Yeah. Dr. Michael Woods is an associate professor and director of the Biosciences Research Lab at the Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Cruces. Dr. Woods, thank you so much for joining us for this program. We also want to thank you for joining us for the statewide call-in program on COVID-19. I'm Anthony Moreno with KRWG Public Media. This was in part of collaboration with New Mexico Public Radio stations KUNM and KANW in Albuquerque and KENW in Portales.